idea, because not only does it get us into the habit of explaining the name that we're talking about and recognizing that not everybody understands what all of our alphabets mean, or say that we're going to have our pig here too. And the so for those who cannot avoid doing the A, B, C, D, E, F, G's, you might as well put your money in now. And we will, and I want to get a consensus from this body, given the magnitude of the problems that the state is facing, and that we have been designated as number one in the country for hunger, that the funds that we collect, that we will give it to the Oregon Food Bank. I understand that they were very responsive last year in general government. They were able to raise $1,000. So this is not any little small stuff, you guys. And so just remember that, Dr. Bates.
Yes, ma'am.
For those who really believe that
they're... Can I stay into it now?
if you want to contribute now, you're quite welcome to do so. Today we will be hearing the Board of Medical Examiners, their overview. We have not yet have our rules, so we will not be doing a work session, but we will take the testimony from the Board of Medical Examiners. And with that, Judy, our legislative fiscal officer, will give us our orientation and our background.
In front of you is the governor's recommended budget packet, and a smaller binder that is actually the budget presentation that the Board of Medical Examiners will provide for you today. Yesterday I delivered to you a packet of information that is my brief summary, the summary of, or the analysis from our office of the governor's budget, and also some background information. And this also included today on your, in front of you is a one-page document that describes the potential additions and deletions to the budget, which we really won't get around to until work session. The Board of Medical Examiners is one of the oldest boards in the state of Oregon. It was created in 1889, I believe. Their function is to regulate the practice of medicine in the state of Oregon. They do that in part by licensing physicians, osteopaths, physicians assistants, podiatrists, and acupuncturists. They also regulate the practice and work with those physicians to ensure that the standard of practice is met in the state, and also take sanction when necessary when the licensees are not living up to the standards. As part of that, they have a what they call the Health Professionals Program, which is in some ways a diversion program to help those who recognize they have problems meeting the requirements of their physician to get the necessary treatment in a non-confrontational way. There is a nationwide shortage of healthcare professionals, and the board is experiencing steady growth in the number of license applications as schools expand to meet the ongoing demand for medical professionals. They are also discovering that the number of new applications are not only growing, but they are requiring more in-depth or specialized review of applicants' history. And also the number of complaints and investigations involving allegations of inappropriate care or treatment have almost doubled over the last 5 years. And the board is dealing with that as well. They've also increased an increasing demand for information about licensees over the internet, and have been working, especially last biennium, to improve their technology access. They have 9 key performance measures, which they will talk to in more detail, but 2 that I wanted to point out to you. So the average number of days required to process an application, an initial application for medical licensure, was taking about 45 days in 2000. Last year it was up to 53 days, and they are continuing to struggle to get that number down. The average number of days to process and mail license renewals, however, has gone down to 10 days as a result of technology driving that they are doing with that. Budget notes from last session included a note for a study of the agency's cash flow, and they will talk about the results of that study in more detail. One of the unique things about this board is that they only renew licenses once a biennium, and they do all of them within the same three-month period.
And there's a reason.
The board is entirely other funded. 96% of their funds come from licensing fees. We are one of the lowest still among all of the states in the Pacific Northwest. Our neighboring states, there's only one state that has a lower license. And
which state is that?
I believe it's Nevada.
Idaho.
And their budget is about $6.89 million, almost entirely from fees, and a few dollars come in from the sale of lists and related materials. With that, I'll turn it over to the board.
Chair, can I make a statement for myself?
I don't know about that, different date, but I think so. If you plan to contribute to the fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the licensing board that watches me, and we're not sure if there's a conflict of interest here or not, so I'm going to declare that right now just to make sure that if there is one, that I recognize it and we know. But maybe you've had a chance to research that. I wasn't sure.
I did. So noted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Kathleen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Medical Examiners. And with me this afternoon is Mr. Bruce Johnson, who's our Assistant Executive Director. And we also have two board members with us this afternoon. We have Professor Suresh Bald, and she's from Willamette University, and Dr. Sheridan Thieringer, who is a family practice physician who practices out at Tuolity Hospital in Hillsboro. He's an osteopathic physician.
Welcome.
I do want to tell Representative Bates, if I may, that I did get a chance to talk to Greg Chamoff, and he said that there would be no problem with you sitting on the budget.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time and attention this afternoon. As stated earlier, the board was founded in 1889, and it was determined by the legislature that to practice medicine was not a right, but it was a privilege. And the primary purpose in establishing the board is to protect the citizens of Oregon. And we reflect that in our mission statement, which goes on to say that not only to protect the health, safety, and well-being of Oregon citizens in the practice of medicine, but also to do so in a manner that promotes quality medical care. And the chief goals of the Board of Medical Examiners are to evaluate applicants for licensure, provide needed information to the public, educate the licensees about the board's policies, investigate complaints, and take appropriate action as necessary, and that may be remedial action or it may be disciplinary action, rehabilitate chemically dependent licensees while also protecting public safety, and to also ensure efficient internal operations. I want to tell you a little bit about our board members. Board members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and they are chosen from congressional districts, so they come from all over the state, and you can see that reflected in our slide. We have 7 medical doctors, 2 doctors of osteopathy, and 2 public members. Now, the board meets as a whole on a quarterly basis, and we did bring for you today a show and tell, and that is our board book. And before each meeting, they are shipped two of these books to review in advance of the board meeting, and it's a 2-day board meeting. So it's a fairly demanding assignment, and they are simply paid for the days in which they sit. So the time they put in preparing that information, there is no per diem paid. So as you can see, it's a real service to the citizens of the state of Oregon. In addition, they do serve on other committees that I will discuss now. We have several committees. One is on administrative affairs, and Professor Bald is the chair of that committee now. And that determines public policy issues, administrative rules, and also evaluates applicants for licensure who may have some past that needs to be reviewed by the board. You may have had a physician that had a difficulty in another state, wants to move to Oregon. That physician needs to be reviewed by this committee. We also have a committee on podiatry, that meets quarterly, as well as the Committee on Acupuncture and Physician Assistants. Those all review the practices of those individual professions. Now, on a monthly basis, the investigative committee meeting takes place, and that is open to public officials. And so we would also invite you to come, if you wish, to observe the investigative committee or the full board meeting as your time allows. The board also has responsibility for the scope of practice for emergency medical technicians and paramedics in the state. In addition, as Ms. James noted, we do have a diversion program that has five physicians that supervise that program. And we have about 100 people under that program right now with substance abuse. They are allowed to practice with the permission of the board so long as they are in compliance with the program. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the milieu that the board operates in. It's constantly changing, which is what makes it very interesting. Never a dull moment. There's a very serious need that the public has for information about their health care professionals, and we try to deliver that to them. They want to know about the quality of care provided and the diversity of care available. Some of the societal factors now that impact medicine are, as Representative Bates noted, some of the malpractice issues that have come to the fore, the high malpractice insurance rates, the shortages in some of the specialties, such as gastroenterology. It takes months to get in to see a gastroenterologist. Some communities don't have these specialties. Another societal factor is the issue of confidentiality, and there is another federal statute coming into play this spring, and I'm not going to use the acronym, even though we fully support the food bank. I'm going to try real hard here. Just as an aside, each of our staff have now given $50 this year to the food bank, so it is a near and dear to us, but I'm still going to try to stay away from the acronyms. But there is a need for confidentiality of patient records, and that impacts our interactions with the physicians and other healthcare professionals. In addition, the business considerations, the changes in the profession from solo practice to now larger practices, some other professions assisting the physicians in their care of patients. The impact of technology is huge on all of us, and it certainly is on the board and on all of our medical professionals. It's just changing every day, and for the medical professionals to stay on top of it is critical. In addition, our agency is responsible to multiple entities. It is to the public, first of all, the citizens, the legislature, our stakeholders, our licensees, the media. Now I'd like to turn your attention, please, to the organization and services. And again, the board is 100% funded with license fees and, as Ms. James noted, some sales of lists. In the license services section, we have two primary program sections here, and the first one includes license services, investigations and compliance, and technical and support services. The second program we have, and that's just divided programmatically, is our health professionals program, our diversion program. Our next slide shows you our organization chart. And Mr. Johnson will take the podium now for the next few slides.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bruce Johnson. This slide shows how the board staff are organized. Board members are appointed by the governor. The executive director answers to and advises our board and is responsible for the operation of the agency. We're organized into five divisions, and if you start at the left of this chart, we have it color-coded for you on the screen. Starting at the left, we have license services, and that division does the initial licensure of our applicants as well as renews the license. Next are the technical and support staff, and they're responsible for the website, for technology, for the fiscal operations, human resources, fiscal and general services. This is a small state agency, but we have all the functions of a larger agency and that we do under our own roof. Next area is investigations and compliance. And then finally, on the far right, is our health professional program, also known as the diversion program. And it is part of the board, but it is located separately in Tigard. And finally, at the top of the chart, we have our administration, which consists of the board, our executive director, and one support person. The Board of Medical Examiners does have a formal management plan, and that was developed about 2 years ago with input from the board, from managers, and from staff. It identifies our high-level goals, it identifies strategies for achieving those goals, and then at a lower level it talks about actual action plans. The board sees this as a work in progress. We're in the midst of an update this month. And we also see it evolving constantly to change to fit public and licensing needs. We have a full copy of the plan in the back of this of your presentation book if you'd care to look at it at some time. The committee subcommittee has asked to see our performance measures and benchmarks, and we have them just simply listed here in the detailed part of our discussion, which is going to be coming later on. We'll get to each and every one of these measures, and we will talk about the actual data, and we will talk about our targets at that time. We just thought it would make more sense when we were discussing the programs. Our measures do tie to two of the statewide primary benchmarks, and these performance measures have been approved by the Progress Board. The board works very hard to contain costs and stretch licensee dollars. To this end, it automates where it can. An example of this is at one point we had, a couple of years ago, our databases were all separate and unlinked. And this meant, for example, when an investigator was trying to find an address for one of the licensees, it didn't always have access to the most up-to-date one on file. And now we've linked all of our databases together, so they all speak to each other. And everybody in the agency has access to the most up-to-date information on an online basis. We continue to make our website work harder, particularly in the area of providing current information to the public. This reduces staff time, and our feeling is the harder we can make our website work, the better. We've also continued to update our management plan, which I mentioned earlier. And finally, we retool our organizational structure at every opportunity to make sure it meets the changing business needs of the public and our licensees. Some of the things that we've done to avoid duplication and to minimize costs, we do coordinate our investigations primarily with other regulatory agencies. We've done some joint and cooperative rulemaking. The most recent example of that is our work with the Health Division in coming up with rules related to disaster planning, and that's an outgrowth of September 11th. We avoid duplication by triaging calls, and we make sure that if somebody from the public does call us, and I want to emphasize when you do call us, you will get a real person and not a recording. If we can't answer your question, we try to find somebody in the state who does. We provide that extra referral. Currently, we are also working with Health Division staff on a statewide patient safety initiative. You also asked to see information about our administrative costs, and they're fairly stable over time. This table shows our administration is comprising our executive director and one support person, and this has averaged around 6% over the last three biennia. This graphic is a kind of a bird's eye view of our information technology system, and starting at the top, you can see that we are connected to the Department of Administrative Services through another agency located in Portland. So we're piggybacking on an existing line, and that saves us some money. Moving down on the right side, the board has a network of 9 servers and 1 mini computer. On the left side, we show that we have 41 PCs connected to our network. And I'd just like to emphasize there's really nothing particularly unusual about our setup here, and we don't make any major changes or additions without first consulting with the State Information Resource and Management Division. Being one of the smaller state agencies, we're quite proud of this information technology system because of the way it serves the information needs of the public. We serve their needs primarily through our website, which we established a little over 4 years ago. It's been very, very popular. The number of visits to our homepage has tripled in a two-year period from 9,000 visits per month to over 29,000 visits per month last year. We're also very aggressive about automating manual processes, which allows us so far to keep up with growth in licenses and to provide them with faster service. And we also share information with other agencies as required by federal and state law, and we're very careful about that. We share with the National Practitioner Data Bank as a result of federal law, and we share with the state, with Oregon State Child Support Division and the Oregon Department of Revenue. We have a second separate network for our health professionals program in Tigard. This one is a small three-person computer system with one server. And this office and its equipment and its databases are separate because of state and federal statutes governing the confidentiality of information of this program, because it is our diversion program. We're proposing no major upgrades in this budget other than replacing some existing equipment that served its useful life. We don't have any contracts other than maintenance contracts on our printers, which is pretty standard, and we have a maintenance contract on our database software. We have quite a few services that we deliver online, and I'll describe those in greater detail in another portion, but we have license profile information for the public. We have fill-in forms, which saves both us and the licensee time, and it saves us the expense of mailing. Last time I looked, we had 43 of our forms online, and we have two out of our four application packets that licensees can access online. And we're also sending a lot of our information electronically as opposed to by paper, by hard disk, and so that has been more efficient as well. I'm going to turn this back over to our executive director.
This is the last slide in our overview, and it is a summary of our report that our agency makes on affirmative action targets. Right now, the board is over parity for women, and compared to 2001-03, our affirmative action report shows an increase of 3% for people of color and a 3% increase for people with disabilities, which results in an overall 6% increase in protected groups. And we do take steps to achieve these affirmative action goals. First of all, we interview all qualified applicants. We do hire temporary employees from St. Vincent de Paul and also from Goodwill Services. And we've hired permanently two protected class employees who came to us from St. Vincent's. We advertise in all the available newspapers. We try to foster more interaction among staff in the office itself. We post the diversity calendar of events, try to involve all staff in some of the different activities that we have in-house. And I think we've made some goal increases in working towards fulfillment of SB 786, and I have that in our appendix as well. So we do try to be attuned to the affirmative action goals of our agency, work within that policy, and I am very proud of our workforce as a result. Thank you very much for listening to our portion of the overview.
Other questions?
Just a comment,
Senator Borley.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you for pointing out the work that you've been doing under Senate Bill 786. You might want to speak more specifically on the record about some of your activities. Again, the intent of 786 was to require that all of our health licensing boards do more in the area of increasing their diversity, both on the board and then also making opportunities to become a member of a given health profession more available to people who might have that interest. So if you could just say more on the record about what you have been doing, it would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'd be happy to, because actually all this has been one of my personal goals as well. We have surveyed all of our licensees and asked them to voluntarily report their racial and ethnic identities. And we also asked them what languages they spoke sufficiently for clinical purposes. And we received a 57% response rate, which we thought was pretty good. And we plan to post the licensee's language ability on our website this spring. That'll be done this spring. We also have a commitment to a diverse board membership, and we do try to work closely with the governor's appointment person, whoever that person is, and work carefully with them to make sure that we do have diverse board membership. And over the last 9 years, we've increased the number of females on the board as well as members of the board who are persons of color. We've consistently used on-site translators as needed. That happens infrequently, but sometimes. And last year, we implemented AT&T's language line service, and that gives us the ability to immediately access a translator if we have a non-English speaking person who calls the board for any information. In addition, we're seeking to collaborate with the Oregon Health Sciences University to fund students in some of their programs and to do some outreach with them to encourage more people, particularly young people who are in elementary and middle schools, high schools, to attend medical school to look at the health professions as something that they could see in their future. And our strategy has really been, in that regard, in terms of the younger students, has been to try to partner with other organizations that have the successful programs that we can work with. And so we also put together a booth with some of the other health licensing boards at one of the health conventions held in Portland this last year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, Jeremy Patton, Department of Administrative Services. I will be going over this handout, which should be in front of you all on the desk. Governor's budget. Feel free to slow me down at any time or interrupt for questions. If you turn to page 2, this is just a brief overview of the board's budget. As you can see, there are about 6.9 million other funds, which is about a 9.6% increase over the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The board consists of about 34 positions. 31 of these positions is in their operations program, and the other three are in diversion. The governor's budget increases the amount of positions in FTE due to an increase in workload sustained by the board, which they will go into in a little bit. Turn to the next page. This is just a slide showing that the board is completely 100% other funds. These other funds are collected through professional licenses, examinations, and other miscellaneous charges. Also, a portion of this annual renewal fee is transferred to the Oregon Health Sciences University to maintain its medical library.
Medical library.
Thank you.
Just a quick question. What are the current fees?
The transfer to OHSU?
No, I'm talking about the amount that Dr. Bates physicians have to pay.
Madam Chair, it's $219 for a license renewal per year.
$219.
Some are less. For example, if a physician is an emeritus physician that is retired but still volunteering and giving their time in the community, that's a reduced fee.
Thank you.
Page 4 of the presentation. This is a brief overview of what's included in the governor's budget. The governor's budget does continue the current level of services provided by the board to its licensees and citizens. It also includes a few enhancement packages for computer upgrades, increased consultant services, and personnel increases, and we'll discuss these packages a little bit later in the presentation. The governor's budget will leave the board with about 14 months ending cash balance, as it currently is. The next slide on page 5 is just an overview of the board's program units. As you can see, the largest program unit is our operations unit, about 89%. The operations provides administration, licensing, investigations, functions of the board. The diversion program provides an intervention, treatment, and monitoring of licensees for substance abuse disorders. And the operations usually just transfers the exact amount of money that...
Is the diversion program in your performance measures and your outcome included in those outcomes?
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
Thank you.
on to page 6. This is just an overview of the budget categories for the board. As you can see, personal services is a large portion of the board's budget. This includes all employee compensation, benefits, wages, temporary staff. The other large piece is the services and supplies piece, which is all the costs for board operations and rent and attorney general. They do have a small capital outlay budget of about $21,000, and this is used for data processing, hardware, and software. Page 7, this is kind of an outline of how we built the governor's budget. As you can see, the board did not come to any emergency boards over the interim. Their only adjustment to their 2001-03 budget was for the compensation plan, which was awarded in the third special session. Under essential packages, there are personal services adjustments or a vacancy savings adjustment of about $3,500. This would bring the total savings for the board to about $32,000 for vacancies. The board also used a standard inflation rate of 3.5% for other personnel increases, temporary appointments, overtime payments, and they received a decrease in mass transit tax. The board did have one program adjustment. They received a package in the 2001 session for a replacement of servers, software upgrades, and interactive web applications, and this money was taken out for next biennium.
Which city did the adjustment come from on the mass transit tax? Why did we have an adjustment, a reduction in the mass transit tax?
Mass transit is calculated on a percentage times salaries and wages, so each year they just kind of recalculate the percentage and make a reduction to what was currently in there.
Do you know what percentage? I know we give to Portland? Salem? Let's see.
Portland, Salem. Eugene, I think.
And Eugene? Do you know by percentage breakouts how much we're... Never mind, I'll ask Department of Administrative Services.
I don't have that information at this time. The board is located in Portland, so I would leave most of the taxes from there. On page 8 of the handout, the first topic is the inflation. The board used the standard inflation factor of 3.5% for most of its services and supplies. The only exception to that is that they receive a 5.3% inflation factor for facilities rent. They're in a non-DAS-owned building in downtown Portland, so rent was a little bit more expensive than the 3.5% allowed. They did receive an exception for that. The next section is program reductions. These are reductions that the analyst has made during the governor's process. The main reduction is of $18,000 for the professional services in the operations program. And what this did is the operations program was reduced in professional services by $18,000 in order to fund a policy package in the diversion program. Yeah. So in the overall scheme of things, there was no reduction or increase in the expenditure limitation. And the board also received some smaller services and supplies reductions when we look back at their actual spending patterns. The first policy package for the board, they did have four policy packages. This first one in operations is for workload management, and this package funds the establishment of one new position and adds full-time equivalency for two other positions. The workload of the board has increased over the past biennium, but positions have remained pretty steady up until now, so the board is going to ask for these in a policy package in order to try and offset some of this increased workload. And the board will discuss this workload later on in their presentation. Next policy package is package 103 for technology upgrade. This includes funding for the purchase of two new servers for database backup and development. It also upgrades the board's network servers and purchases interactive web application software. The board usually comes forward with a package each biennium for replacement of servers, since they do have 9 servers and over time they need to replace those servers. The next package is in the diversion program for an increase in medical consultant services. The package will not increase the limitation. This is the package that was funded through the reduction in professional services from the operations program unit. So although this package shows $18,219, that money is actually taken from operations and put into the diversion program to fund this package. It also includes funds for a consultant services workshop that the board will probably be speaking of in their presentation later. The final package for the board is the workload increases for their diversion program. licensees undergoing diversion have increased in over the past few biennia, and this position kind of goes along with the increased consultant services for the diversion program. It's an increase of 0.20 full-time equivalency, which is another day per week. And this package also includes an upgrade to the program's client tracking system. This system would replace the current manual system for tracking the status of the diversion program participants. And this automated system would also track demographics to help produce statistical studies if the board is asked to see where out in Oregon these diversion participants are located and other demographics. The only real technical adjustment that needs to be made to this board is for the elimination of the merit increases, which Budget and Management Division and Legislative Fiscal Office are currently working on the methodology to reduce that out of all agencies' budgets. Other than that, I'm open to any questions.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. Kathleen, I want to just give you kudos for your work. Madam Chair, I'm dating myself, but in the early 80s, I used to hate to see this board come before us because it was always them and alternative medicine people and everything. It was always like a big fight, and it was the room was crowded and had monitors in other rooms everywhere else. And I want to give this new board chair and Kathleen kudos for the work that you've done in at least talking to people, listening to people, because that was the problem. Nobody, the Board of Medical Examiners was very clear, we don't want to talk to anybody about anything. So to see you talking is really, really great. A couple of questions, and I want to know the success of the diversion program. Again, Madam Chair, when this first started off, practitioners were not taking advantage of it, and we were seeing too much undercover going on in this arena, so I'm just, with Kathleen's and new board chair's direction, are we seeing more practitioners taking advantage of the diversion program, and we're keeping some of them in the field, but helping them at the same time?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that is the case. We are seeing an increase in the use of the diversion program. We're also, from two angles. One is folks that are already in Oregon that may have difficulties, but also in the applicant population that are applying for a licensure. If they have had some type of identified substance abuse problem in another state, we would like to have them reviewed by the diversion program prior to issuing a license, just to make sure that their sobriety is where it needs to be and that they're going to be compliant with our program, too.
You're going to walk us through your successes and your numbers on the diversion program?
Yes, ma'am.
A follow-up.
Thank you. Can you tell me how successful you're being with bringing more people of color into being interested in the medical profession? Mm-hmm. And how successful that is being. I know when we were at the Urban League of Portland, we were working with OHSU in trying to get more people engaged, and I'm just trying to find out what is your success rate in trying to do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I don't really feel that I could speak to that adequately today, so what I would rather do is, one of our board members is a professor at the Oregon Health Sciences University, and I would rather contact her and actually get you some numbers as to what their profile looks like now as compared with the past.
I would appreciate that very much, because you know what, when I get sick, Kathleen, I want everybody there. And so if we don't develop our applicant pool, people across the board, and with us already having nursing shortages, and then all of a sudden we find ourselves having medical shortages in the practitioner field of medicine, and as doctors, I mean, I just don't think that Oregon can continue to go down this path. Mm-hmm. We've got to bring everybody in that is willing to apply themselves and get engaged in the medical profession. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, looking at the personal services portion of your budget at 66.1%, and then looking at your FTEs of 32.4, that yields an average of $140,768 per FTE. And I noticed on your organizational chart you have two positions. I would understand positions being more highly compensated, but for the balance of the staff, that seems to be a substantially higher per position or FTE rate than we find in other agencies. Could you comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think the best comment is what you pointed out already, that first of all, we do have two physicians on staff. All of our other positions are reviewed by the human resources, the personnel section through DAS. So any classification system that we might desire for our employees has to pass through DAS. We do not choose the classification for those positions. It's set by DAS.
I want to go back to your mission statement, because a part of that in your mission statement is promoting quality of care. And in looking at the benchmarks, the two that were chosen, I think they're good, but I'm wondering why, since it is a big issue in Oregon, the issue of malpractice is somehow not included in either your benchmarks of trying to assist in helping with this particular issue, as well as the medical shortage. And I know that you're limited by what you can do because you're licensing and what have you, but I also know that you educate as well sometimes. So we'd just like for you to talk a little about that, since I know all of us are very concerned as to this whole climate, both from the standpoint of what can we do on this side to assist in that particular issue that is huge for this state and other states, and also what can be done with respect to assuring that we have enough physicians and medical providers so that we are truly working towards making sure that we do have quality care.
Madam Chair, where to start on the issue of malpractice? It is a significant problem for physicians, and primarily physicians. I was going to say other healthcare professionals, but I don't think that's true. And I think specific specialties in particular, like obstetrics and gynecology, I almost
got you.
You did. You almost did. I was almost there. Obstetrics and gynecology feel it in particular. The way in which it impacts, I think, the regulatory function is that the board reviews, through its medical director, one of the medical professionals on staff, reviews every case that involves quality of care. And every malpractice case that's a large award, he reviews. If there's multiple small awards, he also reviews them. But what we find is that the award of a malpractice lawsuit does not necessarily correlate to a violation of the Medical Practices Act. It's really sometimes apples and oranges. And as I think we all know in the liability arena, the reasons why one would settle a case don't necessarily mean that bad medicine took place.
Sure.
And the board carefully reviews those cases, and we send them out to consultants as well. So it's not just our medical director that may take a look at a case. He may hire one or two consultants to also take a look at it. I think the unlimited awards are a serious problem, and we'd be happy to assist you in any way possible.
We had had the conversation, and I think I just needed all the rest of the members up here to also hear it, because sometimes we don't get both sides of the discussion, and you're only reading what we read in the paper. And so, Representative Bates. And
thank you, Madam Chair. So that topic's been opened up, and it's a segue to some of the questions I wanted to pose to you, and I think some of the things you struggle with. One is, I commonly hear in this chamber at times that the medical malpractice problem is primarily because of a few bad apples. A very small percentage of physicians are producing the vast majority of malpractice claims. And I know you can't publish that data on individual names, but if you found that to be true or not true, or is it spread across the board?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think I don't have the numbers on this, but I'd be happy to try to look. But I think we're seeing it across the board, because it's happening to some of the best physicians. Doesn't mean they aren't going to be sued. So we may see the outliers in terms of medical regulation, in terms of the folks that have to be disciplined. But those, the malpractice is across the board. And it's really driving some communities such that some of these shortages are taking place, as we've said, like obstetrics and gynecology in Southern Oregon, and certainly the coast experiences some of that as well.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, another segue. One of the concerns that many of us feel about medical malpractice is that we're losing physicians, especially in rural parts of the state, but across the state and in certain specialties. And we are seeing many physicians, we believe, again, this is anecdotal, retiring very early as quickly as they can to avoid malpractice. They don't want to be jeopardized. As far as licensing is concerned, I know you can't tell when someone drops their license right away because it doesn't show, but are you seeing a slowing of licensors coming into the state in certain areas? We've been told that's true, especially in obstetrics and gynecology. And are you seeing a diminution of the number of physicians in the states over the next, or are you expecting to see over the next year or two?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, overall our applications, that doesn't mean licensure, but our applications have been on the increase, significant increase. But that does not necessarily correlate to individual specialties or where they go to practice. And so what we are seeing, I think, is also an increase, significant increase in physician assistants and other related professionals to back up and assist physicians where there aren't any.
Representative Smith. Judy Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for Vance. On page 8 of your slide in your inflation and price adjustments, can you go over that for me again briefly on what your state government service charge adjustment was?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. The inflation for the state government service charges is $4,600.
Yeah.
And that includes all the fees for DAS.
What?
It includes all fees for DAS. I believe the Treasury charges are in there and any central government service charges that the board is charged for.
And the $116,000 is for?
The $116,000 is the 3.5% inflation factor that is given to rent, 12.4% for Attorney General, and 3.5% for all other services and supplies. Sorry, it's for rent. It's actually a 5.3% increase for inflation. But
Madam Chair,
I
have a question for you. What's our philosophy regarding inflation adjustments?
We have been instructed to eliminate the inflation unless it is justified, like you have a contract that's going to require it.
Okay.
And government service charges will be dealt with when those agencies come before.
Okay. And the same thing with the AG and, of course, rent. I know we can't do anything about that. Would be a fixed charge or a contract. Thank you.
Yeah, I should explain this part of the budget was already put together before some decisions were made as to what we would be looking at in the future, and the one that we would be adjusting and possibly eliminating based on the agency is the inflation adjustment. But we can't do them until some of them until we know what AG's costs are going to be and some of the other costs, and then as budgets get put together, we will revisit those and then deal with those adjustments later before we get into work sessions. I have Senator Smith and then Senator Morris. Yeah, you get promoted today.
It's not a promotion.
It's not a promotion. Get that out of your head.
Yeah,
jeez. Number 2-1. Okay.
Thank you. What is the relationship between Oregon Medical Practices Review Organization and the Board of Medical Examiners? OMPRO? Do I get fined?
You're fine. I think it's, excuse me, Representative Smith, I'm going to make you a senator again. He's the keeper of the fine. So,
well, I said the full word. I mean, I said the full term. I just.
I don't think so.
Can we have a ruling from the chair, please?
No, you have
ruling
to
ruling from Representative Smith.
From Representative Smith is the sergeant at arms, and he is in charge of the pig and the fines.
How much do I owe?
Let your conscience be your guide.
And so shall the verdict be.
Senator, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, on occasion we receive cases from Oregon Medical Professional Review Organization. Medical quality of care types of cases.
I guess my question would be, is the activity different than what you do? Is it similar to what you do? Is there some overlap in what you do?
Madam Chair, go ahead.
Would you like to respond to
that? Possibly I can give you some information to be helpful. Mrs. Haley may chime in. The organization you've identified, which I'm not going to call OMPRO because I don't want to pay the fine, I don't want to go through the whole thing of saying it, actually goes out and reviews charts in hospitals and does a very thorough job reviewing those charts on Medicaid and Medicare programs. They have a duty if they find what they consider to be a significant case of negligence or malpractice to report to the board, and they do. It's one of the very few regular routine ways of looking at those charts. Much of what else the board receives, I would assume, is from medical malpractice cases or complaints lodged to the board on a particular physician or other practitioner from either a patient, pharmacist, nurse, or someone who has been aware of a case as an individual. But one of the best sources of information, I believe, is that review that goes on, because it's done by medical professionals, it's done very carefully, and it is a random but effective way of looking at the quality of care being done for these people.
Is that part of what Representative Bates said? A quantitative analysis similar to what we do at med school to get accreditation?
Yes, it is, and in addition to that, as what I just said, they actually get in the charts and read them carefully, compare the charts, and do a real analysis of some of those charts. So it's actually a very, very well done program. It's one of the few ones that does really assure some quality assurance.
Representative Jay Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I'm looking at the facility rental and taxes line item at $404,000. For the biennium, and I understand that the revenue coming into the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners is fee income, but I guess I have to ask the question, what's the opportunity cost to your board paying $200,000 a year for facility rentals and taxes? What if that was cut in half? What could you use that $100,000 for?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm sorry, I'm not on that exact line item. I give you a little background on our rental situation. We just renegotiated a lease for our facility in downtown Portland, and it's costing us currently $1.57 per square foot. I think that's about 10% higher than what state facilities charge, and so I assume that's probably because it is a private facility, there's some profit built in there. We happen to renegotiate at a very good time because downtown Portland is overbuilt with office space, and if there was a time for our lease to come up and to have to be renewed, this was the time. We got a very good rate, and we are and it's also a very well-located office, because that's the center of where most of our licensees are.
Follow up.
What's the square footage?
And it's 9,344 square feet.
I think we're into the next category.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Kathleen Haley, and now we're going to begin the detailed portion of our presentation. And first, I'd like to direct your attention to our license services And that department looks at all the license applications that come before the board and makes sure that all the requirements are fulfilled. And we do have copies of applications if you should want to take a look at it. And our job is to make sure that no one comes into the state, of course, who is not fully qualified and meets those applications. And at the same time, the board has a responsibility to employers and to communities who want to have physicians and other health professionals out there as rapidly as possible. So we are trying to move those applications through as quickly as possible. Each year we process over 2,000 applications. In addition, we verify the training, education, and employment. And we also take a look at renewing licenses. We renew 13,000 licenses each biennium. We also respond to requests for information, and those come from all over. They come from hospitals, insurance companies, and, of course, the public. The license services section also assists investigators. If there's a problem application that comes in, they refer it over to the investigative section. And they develop the policy and set up the committees for the other five adjunct committees, as well as rulemaking responsibility. In terms of license services for physicians, this graph before you shows an average of about 11% increase per year since 1998. And again, the Health Sciences University is able to continue to attract and train physicians. And in fact, more folks apply to go to the Oregon Health Sciences University than is true nationally. In other words, four applicants for every seat at the Health Sciences University, whereas it's two nationally.
Kathleen, can I go back?
Certainly.
We had some discussion in one of the other committees this morning about agencies going back and looking at some of their rules to assure that rules that we don't have aren't rules that we're required or need to have. And, you know, I think that that's very wise because sometimes we promulgate rules and regulations that really are not connected to legislation. And just throwing that out at you because I think as we get into talking about work that we're doing, and I think there is the, and we're looking at performance measures and some of those issues, that we're also looking to assure that we're doing things that are that are connected to the enabling legislation, and that we're not, and your agency might not be one of them, but you might want to think in terms of doing some of those reviews. I know some of the agencies will begin doing that, reviewing their rules and regulations to assure that those regulations are really connected to the statutes and that they're not promulgated for just because it's something that the agency wants to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. In fact, the person who manages the license services section, in addition to managing and working with those five policy committees, is our rule person. And part of our reason for asking for assistance in that group is to do just that, because I think you can always take another look at the rules and streamline them and make them better.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I would also assume that under Senate Bill 786, that in the future we'll be able to look at a page like this and see disaggregated data that would allow us to look at the progress we're making attracting racial and ethnic folks as new licensees.
Madam Chair, I think, Senator Gordley, I think on it's page 40, you should see something like what you're looking for, and if that's not it, we can try to provide it.
Page 40.
In your appendix.
Doesn't show up so well on the overhead there.
See on the bottom.
That's very helpful. Okay. Very useful. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, as I said, I'm going to try to get that other information from the university too for you. When we take a look at the license services for physicians in particular, we see that there are some historical factors, and that is that increase overall in applications of 11% per year, and also we've had some staff turnover in that department. If you turn your attention now to the licensed services for the acupuncturist, physician assistants, and podiatrists, now there's an additional school for physician assistants and also one for acupuncturists in the state, which is why we've seen a 24% increase in acupuncture applications and a 15% per year increase in physician assistant increase in applications. The podiatrists, I think because there isn't a school in Oregon, stay pretty steady at about 10 to 20 applications per year. Also, I think we're seeing now that some insurance companies are paying for complementary and alternative medicine, and there is certainly that public request for that. We've seen HMOs and physician groups hiring more physician assistants, and as I mentioned earlier, some of the rural areas, they're definitely relying on physician assistants. We've been able to put the physician assistant application on the website, and that's been very successful. When we take a look at our program measures for licensed services, you'll see that in 2000, as Ms. James noted, we were able to license a physician in 45 days, and that's grown to 53 days, which is of some concern to us. However, we did do a study on our license renewal and streamlined some of that so that we were able to reduce the time it takes to do our renewals down from 18 days in 1999 to 10 days in 2001. Some of the factors that affect that, of course, are the number of applications and changes in licensing regulations. And we do try to use technology to the extent possible to streamline that.
Sorry to interrupt, but it seems an appropriate time to ask a couple of questions about licensing real quick just so we get this out on the table because we might hear about it later. One is the concern about the increasing length of time it takes to get an application processed because of your increased workload and the need, I think, to screen applicants more closely than you may have had to in the past, and I'm sure you'll get into that if it's questioned. I'm also concerned about the effect it has, though, in some areas, especially areas outside the valley, in rural Oregon, and how it affects rural Oregonians getting physicians into their areas, especially in some subspecialty areas, mm-hmm. as well as in primary care. And maybe you can make a few comments to that. And also some of the hurdles we've had some people have to go through, I think, on a bureaucratic basis, such, I think I mentioned to you already, of a internist or a neurologist having to take a set of exams that didn't pertain to his field, even though he'd been out practicing for 20 years. Could you give a few comments on both of those?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Bates, it's that continual balance for us of protecting the public and making sure that our license requirements are followed. And I think when you compare us nationally, you'll see that we're right in the ballpark in terms of what our requirements are. We do require original documents because, quite frankly, in some of the states there have been forgeries and folks posing as physicians, and thank God, at least in Oregon, we haven't had that kind of thing, and that's the extreme. But at the same time, we are really aware of the employer's needs and try to move people through as quickly as possible. If someone has some troublesome information in their background, however, we do want to have that thoroughly investigated. I suppose one of the things we give our new board members is this book that tells them about this fellow that really wasn't a licensed physician, and basically he was going around the world killing people. And that's something that is the extreme, and we certainly don't want that, and we want to get those specialists out there, but we want to make sure they're qualified to do the job.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
There's a follow-up question. When a physician is discharged from an organization for a major cause, is there any way that linkage or that there's a connection that comes back to you folks that gets into his or her file that would be of value to some other organization, other state, that would be looking to possibly retain this position?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, there is a national data bank. There are actually two now, and really the Federation of State Medical Boards has a third one coming online as well, that identifies those physicians that have had difficulties, that then they are entered in that data bank and are reported to us. We get those reports before we'll license someone. So we are aware of it. In addition, there's a place on the application that asks the applicant to provide that information. And if we discover that they have not been truthful with the board, that can be a grounds for discipline in and of itself. So we're really trying to prevent the idea of someone going from state to state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. I'll continue now with our investigations and compliance overview. And I also believe that one of the important pieces of that department is to provide information to the public. So we do have a complaint resource officer that does refer people as needed. We receive about 1,600 initial complaints and have about 640 written complaints come into the board, and we investigate about 330 of those as possible violations. Now, as I mentioned, our medical director does review those cases to make sure that the standard of care has not been violated, and he also contracts with consultants in the individual field. Because he was a burn specialist, he started the burn center at Emanuel Hospital, but he doesn't know other specialties. He's not a specialist in ear, nose, and throat, so we have to hire those consultants to take a look at those cases. Once a physician or other healthcare professional has been through the disciplinary process, some are placed on probation. And right now we have about 120 people on probation all around the state. And we do have a compliance officer who goes out, meets with a physician in his or her office, and talks with them about whatever the terms of their probation are. And so that information is also available to the public. It's available to the public through our office and through calling, and that's why we still have someone answering the phone, a live person answering the phone, so that you can get that kind of information. If you take a look at the sources of our complaints, you see that, as Dr. Bates mentioned, mostly the complaints do come from patients and family members, but they also come from a variety of other organizations, and we do review all the malpractice cases, as I said earlier. The types of complaints are probably what you would also expect, in that most folks are complaining about inappropriate or incompetent care. However, we also have complaints regarding sexual misconduct, inappropriate prescribing of medications. Our Oregon board was the first board in the country to discipline a physician for underprescribing of pain medicine. And so that was a first. It's kind of created a lot of interest nationally, and other states are taking a look at how did we do that and why did we do that and what was the result of that case. So that's something of a distinguishing feature, because I think sometimes you hear that more of the discipline is for inappropriate prescribing, in that they're prescribing too much pain medication. Some of the factors that do affect that investigative section are the changes in the law, changes in the intractable pain law, some of the regulations that affect the ability to conduct investigations, and also the changes in the confidentiality statute. Now, I'd like to take a look at some of the final dispositions of the board cases, and in particular, note that under the terms of the public orders, the first one there, referred to remedial program, there were 9 referrals in 2000, 13 in 2001, and 22 in 2002. And some of those referrals would be to our diversion program. But the other thing we're trying to do is, if we have good practitioners who make a mistake, to try to get that remediated and get them back out, taking care of the public, ensuring public safety, but at the same time not losing practitioners in Oregon. So I think this chart does reflect that adequately, and also shows you the number of reportable cases, which was 39 in 2002. Now, I'd like to speak briefly with you about the Health Professionals Program, and that does have a physician on staff as well. It's housed in a different place than the medical board, so that there is confidentiality. Folks can go and receive treatment for a substance abuse disorder confidentially. The board doesn't know about it, and then they are monitored through that program once through treatment. And right now they have about 114 people that are being monitored. One of the key functions of that medical director is to get out in the community and speak with hospitals and remind folks about this service, so that they can take advantage of it and can also be out practicing in the profession.
Kathleen, it would be helpful if you would add a category. You have the rate of recovery for the clients, but it would also be helpful to know what the length of time from the time that it began until the person had recovered.
Madam Chair, they monitor folks for 5 years.
The monitoring's for 5 years.
Right.
But I'm actually trying to get from the point of where the illness or the problem was identified and began the treatment and that process, and when, even though they're monitoring, no longer are you in a treatment mode.
Okay. Madam Chair, as soon as they would come to the attention of the medical director of our diversion program, and that might be through peers, it might be through the hospital itself, that licensee would then sign an agreement, and so it's from that date forward. That may include the treatment that they would be with the medical diversion program for 5 years. Now, some folks, believe it or not, actually ask to stay longer.
I understand. Is there somewhere in the process that you could have, even though the person is continuing to be monitored,
mm-hmm.
but they're drug free or they're alcohol free, and I think doctor knows what I'm getting at. In our other programs that we have for alcohol and drug and what have you, those are some of the standards that we require to know. And I just would like to see some way that we can kind of mirror those standards with what you're doing also. It may be valuable information for us as we're making decisions that affect the rest of the public with this particular problem.
And we'll follow up on that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to
Representative.
Just make sure I understand where you're going with this, because I think I know where you're going. The programs we have for healthcare professionals have an extremely high cure rate, 95-96% from the last times I saw the figures, and they continue to be high because they do routine urinalysis and follow-up, and they're spontaneous urinalysis. You have no idea when they're coming, and those usually are carried on for 5 years, and that seems to be at 5 years, if someone's been drug-free for that time, they're usually in a situation where they're not going to go back to alcohol or drug abuse. Programs vary somewhat in whether they're inpatient for a month or 2 or 3 months, and then how much outpatient program goes on. But my general feeling is that usually it's a 1 to 2 month inpatient program followed by close monitoring and continuing counseling for approximately another 8 or 9 months, and then just monitoring after that. But the hammer is that these people have a huge incentive to follow the program, stay in the program, and continue to be evaluated on urinalysis, not on self-reporting. And that's the kind of criteria I think that we'd like to see in other areas, with something that is a negative action that would occur to those people if they don't take part in the program and don't come in for the urinalysis. And those urinalysis are, as I said, the key to them is they're spontaneous. You have to walk in the hospital door and they say, "Dr. Bates, today's your day. You know, mm-hmm. we're going to the lab together." Now, I have not been in a program, but you understand what I'm saying. Okay. That we're trying to go.
You're right on top of that.
Thank you.
See what happens when you work on a committee together for two sessions.
See, we got it. We work together.
Very well. The diversion program does continue to receive about 16 to 27 new referrals per year, and they do, as I mentioned, try to make educational presentations around the state so that folks are aware that they're there and can take advantage of the program. There have been some changes in the federal confidentiality and treatment protocols that do affect their ability to deliver services. And at this point, I would like to refer you to Mr. Johnson, who's going to cover the technical and support services, unless you have any questions for me at this point.
Madam Chair, for the record, Bruce Johnson. We have two priorities in technical and support services. The first priority is to provide current and accurate information to the public, and the second is to provide technical and support services that enable board staff and employees to better serve the public. One of the major services that we provide in this department is the maintenance and updating of our website. On this next overhead, it shows our homepage. This is on page 27, and I believe I mentioned earlier that visits to our site are up 50% just in 1 year. And I'll just briefly review some of the information that we have that you can access by going to our home site. We have board actions, which summarize recent discipline against licensees. We have a way of showing the public how to file a complaint. And another major cost saving for us, and I brought that up earlier, is you can access our forms that we've made available. Again, this saves the time and taking of the request over the phone and mailing out the form. One of the indications that we have that our site is getting used is just the number of written license verifications that we're doing, and it's actually down. In 1997-99, we were doing 3,700 license verifications per year. That's down to 2,000 the last time we looked, and we attribute that to the fact that people are getting the information off of our website instead of calling us, so we like to see that happen. The next slide shows you what...
Excuse me, do you get a loud voice when you call your...
Madam Chair, you do. And you will for as long as we can here. On the next slide, we show you what information is available on our licensees through a website feature called DocFinder. And we've received very positive comments from the public on this because it helps them in their search for a provider. Some of the information items that are important to the public are license standing, and we just happen to select this one particular physician. His name is Dr. Glass, and it shows that he has an unrestricted license. And if you click on that, that'll tell you that he has never been disciplined by the board. And we have some new information that we've added just in the last year. One is the physician's practice address and that he speaks Spanish sufficiently for clinical purposes. Finally, I'd like to point out that for an agency of only 31 people, we do provide all the traditional services commonly found in the larger agencies, and these include the support functions of fiscal services, human resources, information technology, purchasing, contracting, and telecommunications, the whole ball of wax. We have some program measures as well. One of them is the number of hits on the board's website per month. In 2001, it was 18,129. That's climbed to 27,120 the last calendar year. Also, the percentage of license forms generated on the website. In 2001, it was 31%. Now it's almost half, and we really like to see this happen. What we've done is we put a little watermark on the forms that we have posted on the web so that when somebody from the public or a licensee in their office generates a form on their printer in their home or their office and sends it in, we know it's from that source. So it's very encouraging to see that fully half of our forms are coming in from the end user. In addition, we've consistently received an annual Gold Star certificate from the State Controller Division for submitting accurate and complete fiscal information in a timely manner. The factors affecting our services include budgetary limitations, and we'll be discussing those specifically with you when we go over our policy option requests. And also another factor is the number of requests that we get for data, both over the phone and in written form. And the cost factor here is not just the sheer volume, but the cost for us is to make sure that our data is absolutely accurate because hospitals and other providers, insurance companies are depending on this data. We need to make sure it's accurate. We need to make sure that it's secure from viral attacks. And we need to make sure that it keeps up with the ever-changing requirements regarding confidentiality. I'm going to turn this back over to our executive director for the next slide.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to talk briefly about the administrative section of our office. And our primary responsibility is to make sure that the board members have the tools they need to carry out the mission. We try to identify policy and legal issues that may come to their attention, bring them to them as necessary, both through the committee process and also at the full board. Professor Ball just told me she cannot lift that big book anymore, and so we're going to get her extra books so that it's not such a hard trip for her to be picking those kinds of things. So we're doing everything from trying to get whatever the board members need to identifying legal issues that may be coming their way. And we also are the link between the board members and the staff, and the link between our board and other boards nationally. Some of the trends that do affect our services are the number of licensees, the way in which health care is being delivered now and how our licensees are responding to that, and some of the general overall changes in Oregon law that affect health care. One of the things that we tried to measure this time is to take a look. We do go out and make presentations, both to the in the medical field and also in the community. And our medical director talks about how to prescribe pain medications in the state, and he does that regularly. So we started measuring what did people think of these talks. Were we really hitting the mark with it? And they said in 92% of the cases that the presentation was good or better. Briefly, I'd like to refer you to our agency accomplishments, and we try to talk to all the staff about that. And this is outside of their day-to-day work that they need to do. We need to sit back at the end of the year and say, okay, in addition to our regular, what did we accomplish? And I don't want to go through each one of these with you, but we have set up, as I said, an early identification program for those standard of care cases that are not a violation of the law but are identifying a problem early with a physician or other practitioner. And we set up the same relationship with all the residency programs, and we're starting to see the fruits of the labor of putting that those agreements together. We have a new license database, and as Mr. Johnson mentioned, we're continually working to update our website, and we have a committee in-house that works on doing that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I would think and I would hope that you would claim your accomplishments under Senate Bill 786 as a part of that list. The work that you're achieving is remarkable.
Mm.
And it's new and it's exciting, and it's a statement about a different quality of leadership, certainly on the part of the executive director, but also on the part of the board. So I'd like to see you add number 14, your work and accomplishments under Senate Bill 786.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you for your legislative leadership on it.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name again is Bruce Johnson. The Board of Medical Examiners is 100% fee supported. 96% of our of this is from license fees, and 4% comes from the sale of lists and license verifications. We receive no general fund dollars for our budget. This chart also shows the numeric and percentage breakdown between our four different license groups. The numbers of in each group and the amount of revenue that each group contributes. One of the information pieces on the next slide that you asked us to bring is our record of our historical expenditures and our budgeted amounts, which I've listed on this chart along with...
Senator Carter.
Ms. Johnson, can you tell me, let's see, out of the 12,355 number of licenses that you... registered this afternoon. How many of these are from Oregon schools?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we may need to research that for you, if we may.
How successful we are doing in this state. We have a medical school here, and at one point, our medical school was not very high on taking graduates from our state who went to the medical school here. So I was just wondering, how of these 12,355, how many are from Oregon schools?
We'll find that out for you, Senator
Thank
Carter.
You.
Madam Chair, I'll continue with the slide on page 33. It's one of the. It shows our historical expenditures and our budgeted amounts, which I've listed here. Of note is that it's been 6 years since we've come to the legislature with any increase request for an increased number of positions, but we do find it necessary to make a modest proposal for this budget, and we'll get into more detail on that a little later. In terms of our budget development process, this shows the board's budget development. In particular, you asked for some detail on our essential packages, which is towards the bottom of the overhead. And essential packages is kind of a technical process, and it combines various technical adjustments, phase-in and phase-outs for certain one-time expenditures, and adjustments for inflation. And when these three items are added up and netted out, it shows a gain of approximately $64,000. And again, that's before the legislature has made any of its decisions on what to do with that. But that's what the governor's budget shows at this point. The governor did trim our agency request by some $68,000, and these cuts included the following. We were seeking to increase a part-time investigative support position from 3 days a week to full-time, and that was approved for 4 days. Also, a reclassification of an existing position was not approved. And finally, as Mr. Patton remarked earlier in his presentation, that the governor is recommending a shift of funds out of our base budget to fund one of our policy option packages. And I'm going to get to that on our next slide, which shows our four policy option packages. Starting with package 101, this is a workload package related to meeting the need to process the increasing number of license applications that we're getting. The major piece of this is to fund a new full-time license coordinator position. And that's to handle the increase that we're getting, 11% per year, in physician applications and the combined 20% increase per year in physician assistant and acupuncture applications. We also would like this position to help review the increasing number of applications that require special review because they present some sort of problem. We'd also like the position to assist with the increasing rules writing activity, and we would hope to as well include the chair's idea about reviewing the existing rules, too, to make sure that they are still appropriate. I'd like to add that this position was reviewed by the State Human Resources Division to make sure that we were seeking the proper classification for this position. A second piece is to increase our medical director position. Our medical director is a physician. Currently, he is working he is working part-time 4 days a week. We'd like to increase that to full-time. This position has seen a dramatic increase in the number of cases that they need to review. It's gone up from 355 per year to 541 in a four-year period. The cases are getting more complex, and he is also reviewing an increasing number of problem applications. Again, it's related to that number that's coming in for the full-time license position. The third piece is to increase the clerical support for the medical director. Obviously, this position is getting an increased workload as well because of the medical director. So what we have with all three of these positions is one long pipeline. At the beginning of the pipeline, we have an increased number of applications. That needs to be handled by the full-time position that we're asking for. The applications need to be reviewed by the medical director. That's why we want to increase his position, and then he needs some additional support staff. Package 102. This requests an increase in the number of medical consultant hours for the diversion program and to provide training for them. Historically, our diversion program has been monitoring some 1 to 1.5% of the board's active licensees. During 2001, however, they experienced an increase. It jumped from an average of 37 per year of referrals to 63. And most of that increase is due, again, and you'll hear this theme throughout these packages, is because of the increased number of applicants we're getting that disclose a history of substance abuse, and they're referred by the board to this program as a condition of getting licensed. So again, another bulge in the pipeline. To cope with this increase, we're seeking funding for medical consultants. And here's what medical consultants do for this program. They conduct interventions, usually with the diversion staff. They assist in assessments, evaluations, and treatment plans. They provide continuing care monitoring of the people who come into the program, including looking at the random urine monitoring as requested. And they provide oral and written reports to the board to make sure that the board is aware of whether they are safe to practice or not. So the cost for this additional consultants is projected at roughly $8,200, and that's going to provide us with about 115 more hours of medical consultant for this program. The second piece...
$8,000 or $18,000?
$8,200 for this piece.
Oh, you're breaking. Oh, excuse me.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, excuse me. It's this piece of the package.
He still thinks there's a rattlesnake down there. For those who don't know, my good representative has a rattlesnake in his office.
He does not.
It's stuffed.
It's stuffed. It's big.
The question is it alive? You know, or is it Memorex?
You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The second piece of this package is funding for the consultants that I was just speaking about. This will provide continuing education to make sure that these consultants, who are widely scattered around the state and who have limited contact with the home office, as it were, remain both current in their understanding of the program requirements and their knowledge of new trends in addiction medicine. So for this reason, we're requesting fees for instructors, facilities, rental, teaching aids, and so forth. And the total for this package comes to $10,000, which gets to the $18,000 that I believe Representative Westland was asking us about. I might add as a reminder that the governor is proposing that we fund this package out of a transfer from our base operations in the other part of our budget. So if that happens, it would result in a budget-neutral fund shift rather than an increase in our budget. Package 103 is for technology initiatives in the amount of $29,950. The board's computer equipment includes some outdated hardware, and some of it's been overwhelmed by the as we automate our processes. And to remedy this, we're seeking funds to get two dual-purpose servers. And additionally, we'd like to improve our customer service by purchasing software so that licensees can update their own change of address online. Now, regarding the two servers, one would act as a database backup and development server. Right now, I want to assure the committee that our data is backed up, but we don't have a backup for the hardware. So that's what this would buy. The other server would replace a network file server that dates to 1995, so this is just a replacement issue for us. The third piece of the package is to fund the development of software that would allow licensees to update their addresses online. Now, in our statute, licensees are required to report address changes no later than 30 days after they move. It's very important because we may need to get a hold of them. Failure to do so results in an automatic lapse of their license. On average, we receive about several hundred address changes per month that need to be entered into our record. So we'd like to make it easier for licensees to comply with this and by giving them that ability. So we estimate the cost of developing this software at about $10,000. I might add that the Information Resources Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services, no acronyms here, has reviewed this proposal and does not have...
You guys are good.
My quarter ready. Does not have any objection to our plans for this.
You might view the budget more favorably if they were bad.
Right. I mean, you know, they're not helping me along on my mission.
A pig's got to be full by the time you leave, so figure it out.
Put it in.
My boss's money, I'll put it in. Package 104. In this package, we seek to increase the diversion program support position from 3 days a week to 4 days a week. And this is the last bulge in that applicant pipeline. But I'm bringing it up separately because it's in a different part of our budget structure. I'd mentioned earlier that diversion was experiencing an increase in referrals from the board because of new applicants who disclose a history of substance abuse. What this position does, this part-time clerical support position, it serves as an initial contact person for people who call the program. She assists in coordinating interventions, maintains a reporting system, sets up random urine monitoring, and most importantly, provides office coverage. And we'd like to increase that coverage from 3 days a week to 4 days a week.
Senator Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kathleen, can you tell me, whether I know what this program got a rough start, and I'm dating myself, but do you think it's because the privacy piece that more people are reporting as opposed to necessarily an increase in the number of people who are, having substance abuse problems, whether it's drugs or alcohol?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think it is really the awareness, as you mentioned. It's the awareness that the program is there, that it's available, that it doesn't mean that it's the end of a career to have a substance abuse problem, that it can be treated, that it is an illness. I think all that educational piece has been a big plus. And the interventions, I mean, if they get a call on a Friday afternoon, you can call over there, and the two people that do the interventions are gone wherever they need to go in the state, and they'll get out there and make sure folks get into treatment.
Wow. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the second piece of this last package, Package 104, is for client tracking software. Now, client tracking is the record-keeping process to ensure that clients throughout the state are where they should be in their recovery process, and that they're meeting with their treating physicians, and that their lab reports are posted, and that they're free from relapse. It's essential to this public protection efforts that this process be timely and accurate. Now, currently they're using a manual system, which is not as efficient as what we're proposing, and it's worked fine for many years, but they've reached the point now where they're getting more clients, and they would really benefit by having a better tracking tool.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, are we seeing more of physicians and PAs with alcohol and drug-related problems, or are we just seeing more reporting and getting in the system, getting them treated, or do you have any idea what's going on here? I mean, you mentioned a couple times you're getting more license applications to indicate substance abuse. Are we getting the wrong people applying? Is it just more reporting? Is it a change in the medical professions?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think it would be more anecdotal than having real hard information about some of the increases. We are seeing, I'm reviewing about 30% of the applications that come in at this point for having some kind of difficulty, whether it's not just in what we would call an average malpractice history, but some very serious awards where the board may want to take a look at the actual patient files before they'll license someone, all the way to someone who's maybe already been through a diversion program in another state. So we're seeing kind of a wide range of what we would say problem kinds of files that we're taking a look at. We are seeing an increase in mental health issues, and I think that can be related, and this is just, of course, my opinion and anecdotal, but to some of the pressures in the profession right now.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll continue. I just have to cover a couple of budget notes that you asked to hear about before turning back to our executive director for concluding remarks. Two budget notes. One is a license renewal study, and we were asked to report on the progress in fulfilling the last legislature's directive to examine the desirability of changing our license renewal schedule from a biennial process, one that's renewing every 2 years, to one based on licensee birthday. To respond to this note, we hired an MBA student from across the street over here from Willamette University to conduct a study. And before the study was started, the board consulted with our budget and management analyst at the time and with our legislative fiscal officer, who was John Britton at that time, and added in the things that they wanted to see us take a look at. So we put those things together, and this graduate student did a study for us. The board ended up concurring with the findings of the report, which recommended retaining our current biennial system of renewing licensees, at least for the foreseeable future. And the major reason boils down to not fixing something that isn't broken. The current system works very well. It only takes 3 staff to do this biennial renewal. When it occurs, what we do is we go out and hire 3 or 4 temporary workers from Goodwill Industries, and that gets us over the seasonal hump for this program. If we were to go to a birthday system, we would have to hire full-time staff, which I think would be more expensive in the long run. A birthday system would also be inconvenient, and we know this because we surveyed these people, would be inconvenient for hospitals and clinic administrators who would have to constantly check to see if their licensees had a renewed license and were in good standing. Now they just have to check with us once every 2 years at a specific period of time, and we've made that very easy for them. And again, that's so out of this process, and we've mentioned it earlier, we really have it down to a science. We heard you very loud and clear, and we took a good look at it, and as a result, we got the number of renewal days down from 18 days to 10 days. So it was a very useful exercise, but the board is recommending that we stay with what we have. A second budget note has to do with our bus pass subsidy program. In the last session, we were given the green light to subsidize by 50% transit passes for our employees, and you asked us to update you on that program and its effect on employee retention. The board is located in downtown Portland. Approximately 67% of the employees at the board's main office purchase bus tickets at the subsidized rate. To find out how important bus passes were to people who applied to work at the board, we developed a survey question that we asked them at the time of their interview. And here's what we asked them. If you were offered a job by another employer in downtown Portland and by the Board of Medical Examiners, everything else being equal, salary, size of office, the position duties, etc., would payment of your 50% of your bus pass influence you in accepting a position with the Board of Medical Examiners over the other employer? And the response to the survey was 15% yes, and 85% yes, and 15% no. We believe from employees' participation and from these surveys that the board's TriMet bus program is an incentive to current and new employees. And more important, because we are located in Portland, we believe that this small program can be considered one of the many steps the state is taking to a more sustainable future. Thank you very much, and if there's no other questions, I'm going to turn this over to our Executive Director.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to thank you very much for your time and attention. And of course, we can answer any additional questions that you have, but also to let you know that we appreciate your service on behalf of Oregonians and would ask for your favorable review of our budget so that the board can continue its work.
Well, I would like to thank you and commend you. I was sitting here and thinking of last session where we talked performances and outcome measures, and we talked about what we would like to see the agencies the next time around, and you've done a yeoman's job. I thoroughly appreciate it, and I think even for members who have not served on this committee before, it's you can track what you're doing, you know why you're doing it, and your outcomes. And so I just want to thank you for your presentation and the work that you've put in it. And I, if Senator Yee was here, I'm certain that the good Senator Yee would have said, you've done a job well done. And if the other agencies are listening, this is what we have been asking for. We asked for it last session, and I want to thank you for presenting that to us. I am sorry, however, that you did such a yeoman's job on your alphabet soup that Miss Piggy isn't feeling too good today. It's kind of interesting, and I do know that oftentimes in the medical community they may not use as many acronyms as some of the other communities either, except for the OMAs and the ITISes. But I do thank you, and I think that this panel really appreciates the your presentation and the comprehensive way in which you presented it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Reverend Westland,
I want to clear up before we leave this. Kathleen, is it not true that most of your problem applications come from a small southern Oregon town that
begins with the letter A from hair follicle challenge physician. I mean, there is
there's some confidentiality involved here, I would point out. Okay.
I don't believe she's going to come.
I'm ready for an answer. Smart woman she is.
She is very smart.
Madam Chair, I refuse to answer on the grounds that this man.
Well, with that, I will see everyone tomorrow. And we are, if there's no further questions.
Well, you, the agenda is connected.
Is that all?